will increase the flow of blood into an area by increasing the temperature of the tissue. For example, heat can be generated within muscle by the use of shortwave or ultrasonic radiation. Deep massage and active exercise will do the same thing. Contrary to what one might expect, a hot pack will not increase blood flow since the heat does not penetrate the skin, let alone reach the muscle. Paradoxically, an ice pack may increase it by stimulating a reflex response to the cold. But what does one accomplish by doing this? Unless the pain is somehow the result of decreased blood flow or reduced oxygenation resulting from some other mechanism, increasing available oxygen is of no value. As you are aware, it is our hypothesis, now supported by rheumatology research, that oxygen deprivation is precisely the mechanism of TMS muscle pain. Nevertheless, I do not use these therapeutic modalities because they are only of temporary value and because they are physical. The use of radiation, these days mostly ultrasonic, the application of hot or cold packs, deep and superficial massage, and active exercise are widely used in the treatment of pain syndromes almost regardless of presumed etiology. For example, a diagnosis of herniated disc is made, but it is decided that surgery is not warranted. In that case, after a period of rest in bed, physical therapy will often be prescribed if pain continues, usually consisting of deep heat, massage, and exercise. It is difficult to understand what this is intended to do. It will not change the anatomical status of the extruded disc material. It will temporarily increase blood flow and may tone up muscles, but to what end? As one who wrote this prescription perhaps thousands of times many years ago, I must confess that the rationale was often fuzzy and there was not a little wishful thinking involved. I would think, do something and maybe the pain will go away. Strengthen the abdominal and back muscles to support the spine. Relax the muscles. And so forth. If the physical therapist was particularly talented, the results were often very good. Alas, here again was the placebo response at work, meaning that the result was usually not permanent. However, if the therapist remained available to the patient, another round of therapy might result in pain relief for a few more weeks or months. But the patient continued to live a life circumscribed by many prohibitions and admonitions, and the always present fear of a recurrence of pain. My immediate response to any treatment to combat inflammation is, what inflammation? To the best of my knowledge, no one has ever demonstrated the existence of an inflammatory process in any back pain syndrome, and yet, enormous amounts of steroidal and non-steroidal anti-inflammatory medication are used in treatment both prescription and non-prescription. Judging the efficacy of these drugs is a bit difficult, because most of them have analgesic or pain-killing abilities as well. Since there is no inflammation in TMS, one must assume that improvement with these is due either to their pain-killing function or the placebo effect, with one exception. Steroids, so-called cortisone drugs, will reduce or banish the symptoms of TMS temporarily in many patients. I do not know how or why this happens. I see these people when the pain returns. They have TMS, and they usually respond to treatment with permanent resolution of symptoms. It bears repeating here that treating chronic pain is not medically sound. Pain is a symptom like fever. It has been elevated to the status of a separate disorder on the hypothesis that certain psychological factors cause the patient to exaggerate the pain. As I stated before, this theory requires that one acknowledge the continuing presence of a structural reason for the pain, which is then exaggerated. In my experience, in both the mild and the severe, the acute and the chronic pain syndromes, in the majority of patients, it is the physiologic changes characteristic of TMS that are responsible for the pain and not a structural abnormality. These physiologic alterations result in pain and other symptoms. To treat those symptoms is no wiser than treating the fever in someone with pneumococcal pneumonia. Where did this chronic pain theory come from? The problem originated with the failure of physicians to accurately diagnose the reason for the pain. Then, when it became severe, chronic, and disabling, they threw up their hands and hoped that someone would relieve them of the burden of caring for these patients. Physicians were happy to shift the responsibility when the behavioral psychologists came along with the theory that psychological needs created a brand new disorder which they called chronic pain. Pain was elevated to the status of a disease by psychological fiat when frustrated physicians abrogated their appropriate role as diagnosticians. Pain is, has been, and always will be a symptom. If it becomes severe and chronic, it is because that which is causing it is severe and has gone unrecognized. Chronicity, in the case of these pain syndromes, is a function of faulty diagnosis. Here's a case history that makes this clear. The patient was a middle-aged woman with a grown-up family. She'd been essentially bedridden for about 2 years when she came to our attention. She had suffered from low back and leg pain for years, had been operated on twice, and had gradually deteriorated to the point where her life was restricted almost entirely to her upstairs bedroom. She was admitted to the hospital, where we found no evidence of a continuing structural problem, but severe manifestations of TMS. And no wonder, for the psychological evaluation revealed that she had endured terrible sexual and psychological abuse as a child. She was in a rage, to put it mildly, and had no awareness of it. She was a pleasant, motherly sort of woman, the kind that would automatically repress anger, and so it festered in her for years, always kept in check by the severe pain syndrome. Her recovery was stormy, for as the details of her life came out and she began to acknowledge her fury, she experienced a variety of physical symptoms: cardiocirculatory, gastrointestinal, allergic. But the pain began to recede. Group and individual psychotherapy was intense. Fortunately, she was very intelligent and grasped the concepts of TMS quickly. As the pain reduced, the staff helped to get her mobile again. 14 weeks after admission, she went home, essentially free of pain and ready to resume her life again. This woman did not have the disease chronic pain. She had a physical disorder, TMS, induced by fearful psychological trauma. What a disservice to her if it had been implied that her pain was so great and persistent because she was deriving psychological benefit from it. Thus, just one example of why I am opposed to this concept. And as well, this example may explain my insistence that the treatment of TMS requires an educational psychotherapeutic approach. Most patients do not need psychotherapy, but they do need to know that all of us generate and repress bad feelings, and that these feelings may be the cause of physical symptoms. My treatment of TMS has evolved over the past 27 years in response to a clear-cut diagnostic concept, that the pain syndromes are the result of the mind-body interaction. When it began to dawn on me that this was the case, my automatic reaction was to explain to the patient what I thought was going on. At the same time, I prescribed physical therapy for everybody, as I had always done. My reasoning was that such therapy could not hurt, and since I believed that oxygen deprivation was responsible for the symptoms, it might actually be beneficial, since all the modalities I prescribed tended to increase the local circulation of blood. As time went on, something interesting emerged. I found that most of the patients who got better were those who accepted the idea that their pain was the result of emotional factors. Some who improved remained skeptical of the diagnosis, but responded well to the physical therapy. It was also apparent that some physical therapists were more successful than others, Based on these observations, two therapeutic conclusions were reached. One, the most important factor in recovery is that the person must be made aware of what is going on. In other words, that the information provided is the penicillin for this disorder. Two, some patients will respond to physical therapy and/or the physical therapist with a placebo reaction. A placebo reaction is fine, but it is usually temporary. Our goal was to effect a complete and permanent cure. The effectiveness of the placebo reaction was easy to understand, but I was mystified by the obvious importance of informing the patient of what was going on. This was knowledge therapy, and it appeared to make no sense at all. However, I was delighted with its effectiveness, and my cure rate was distinctly better. In addition, I finally had the feeling that I knew what was going on, despite my inability to explain all the details. That wasn't too upsetting, for after all, we were dealing with a process of the brain, and it is common knowledge that little is known about how the brain works. During this period, I worked closely with a group of talented physical therapists who had learned all about the tension myositis syndrome and combined their physical treatment with discussion of the psychological factors involved. They functioned as surrogates for me, as well as physical therapists. It was a painful decision to stop using physical therapy later on, because I so appreciated the work of these dedicated professionals. Also, during those early years, I developed a close working relationship with a small group of psychologists on the staff of the Howard A. Rusk Institute of Rehabilitation Medicine, an association that has continued to this day. I learned a lot of psychology from them, and they have played an important role in the treatment of those patients who need psychotherapy in order to get better. In essence, we function as a team. In 1979, perhaps later than I should have, I began to bring groups of patients together for what one might call lecture discussions. With each passing year, it became increasingly obvious that educating the patient about TMS was the crucial therapeutic factor. Occasionally, I would see a patient who had been psychoanalyzed or had been in psychotherapy for a long time, but had a pain syndrome nevertheless. So it was clear that psychological insight was not sufficient to prevent TMS. It wasn't until patients learned the facts about TMS that the pain went away. Starting with 4 1-hour lectures, we evolved to 2 2-hour sessions, the first of which is devoted to the physiology and the diagnosis of TMS, and the second to the psychology of TMS and its treatment. The reason for the lectures was clear. If the information was so important to patients' recovery, then they had to be well educated about TMS. More specifically, it was essential that patients knew exactly what they didn't have, all the structural diagnoses, and what they did have, TMS. From a strictly physical point of view, TMS is harmless. Therefore, they had nothing to worry about physically. All the prohibitions and admonitions were unnecessary. Indeed, they actually contributed to the problem by creating fear where none was appropriate. If the purpose of the pain is to make one focus on the body, and through these lectures the patient can be convinced to ignore the bodily symptoms and think about psychological things instead, haven't we made the pain syndrome useless? It's a bit like blowing the cover on a covert operation. As long as the person remains unaware that the pain is serving as a distraction, it will continue to do so, undisturbed. But the moment the realization sinks in, and it must sink in, for mere intellectual appreciation of the process is not enough, then the deception doesn't work anymore. Pain stops, for there is no further need for the pain. And it's the information that gets the job done. If I can convince the conscious mind that TMS is not serious and not worthy of its attention, better yet, that it is a phony, a charade, and that rather than fear it, one should ridicule it, If I can convince the conscious mind that most of the structural diagnoses are not valid and that the only things worthy of one's attention are the repressed feelings, what has been accomplished? We will have made the TMS useless. It will no longer have the ability to attract the attention of the conscious mind. The defense is a failure. The cover is blown. The camouflage is removed. Which means the pain ceases. If that all sounds like something out of science fiction or Grimm's fairy tales, one can only say that it works, and has worked, in thousands of people over the last 27 years. Here's a striking story to illustrate the point. A woman from out of town went through the program and had a good result. Within a few weeks after the lectures, her pain was gone, and she resumed all her old activities, including tennis and running. One day, about 9 months after completing the program, she was out running and developed a pain in a new location, the outer aspect of one of her hips, another manifestation of TMS. She phoned me and told me that she saw her local doctor who said she had bursitis in the hip. He put her through x-rays, injections, and medication. While talking to me, she admitted that she was in a lot of pain and had been for 3 weeks, and that I was right to scold her for not calling me. In a later call, she informed me that after talking to me, she stood for several minutes reflecting, and she got mad, really angry at herself, and especially at her brain for having pulled that stunt. And she ended up having quite a talk with her brain. Within 2 minutes, the pain was totally gone and had not recurred. Amazed at how quickly her pain disappeared, she began to jog again, concentrating on the real problem, unconscious anxiety about hurting herself during exercise. The point of this story is that the information was the crucial factor, and that it worked so quickly because she had already been through our program and had integrated, meaning she had accepted at a deeper level, the concepts of TMS. The pain would not have disappeared instantly if she had not already known about TMS. But because she did know about it, because she had been through the lecture program, the moment she realized that the hip pain was another manifestation of TMS, it disappeared. Why? Because it could no longer successfully hold her attention as a legitimate physical disorder and could no longer distract her from the world of her emotions. But then you might ask, why did she have a recurrence of pain at all? The occurrence of pain in TMS always signifies the presence of repressed anger, usually to the point of rage. Then you might ask, but your program is supposed to prevent this sort of thing from happening. What happened here? The fact that this lady developed pain in a new place tells us that her brain was still trying to use the TMS to hide her rage and prevent it from coming out. I discussed this with her, and we agreed that if it happened again, it might be wise to consider psychotherapy. The treatment program rests on two pillars. One, the acquisition of knowledge, of insight into the nature of the disorder. Two, the ability to act on that knowledge and thereby change the brain's behavior. So, one must learn all about TMS, what actually causes the pain and what part of the brain is responsible. Then one reviews the psychology of the disorder, the fact that we all tend to generate anger and anxiety in this culture, and that the more compulsive and perfectionistic of us generate a lot. What one must then do is develop the habit of, quote, thinking psychological instead of physical. In other words, I suggest to patients that when they find themselves being aware of the pain, they must consciously and forcefully shift their attention to something psychological, perhaps something they are worried about, a chronic family or financial problem, a recurrent source of irritation, anything in the psychological realm. That sends a message to the brain that they're no longer deceived by the pain. When that message reaches the depth of the mind, the unconscious, the pain ceases. That brings up an important point. Of course, everyone wants the pain to go away immediately. Patients often say, "All right, I understand very clearly what you're saying. Why doesn't the pain stop?" The last lines of a poem by Edna St. Vincent Millay illustrate the reason why the pain doesn't disappear quickly. "Pity me that the heart is slow to learn what the swift mind beholds at every turn." If we substitute the words unconscious mind for heart, the point will be clear. The conscious mind is swift. It can grasp and accept things quickly. The unconscious is slow, deliberate, not quick to accept new ideas and change, which is no doubt a very good thing. Were it not so, humans would be very unstable animals. However, at times like these, when we want things to change quickly, we are impatient with a lumbering unconscious. Well, how long does it take for the pain to go? Though I am reluctant to talk about numbers, experience has shown that the majority will have resolution of most of their symptoms in 2 to 6 weeks after the lectures. Patients are warned, however, that the time may be prolonged if they count the days or weeks or become discouraged if the pain isn't gone when they think it should be gone. Human beings are not machines, and there are many factors tending to vary the time of resolution. How strong are the repressed emotions? How much fear has the person built up over the years? How readily can he or she repudiate the structural diagnoses with which they came? Another useful strategy sounds silly at first, but it has great merit. Patients are encouraged to talk to their brains. So many patients reported having done this on their own with good results that I now routinely suggest it, despite lingering feelings of foolishness. What one is doing is consciously taking charge, instead of feeling the helpless, intimidated victim, which is so common in people with this syndrome. The person is asserting himself, telling the brain that he is not going to put up with this state of affairs, and it works. Patients report that they can actually abort an episode of pain by doing this. Perhaps the most important but most difficult thing that patients must do is to resume all physical activity, including the most vigorous. This means overcoming the fear of bending, lifting, jogging, playing tennis, or any other sport, and 100 other common physical things. It means unlearning all the nonsense about the correct way you are supposed to bend, lift, sit, stand, lie in bed, which swimming strokes are good and bad, what kind of chair or mattress you must use, what shoes or corset or brace you must wear, and many other bits of medical mythology. The various health disciplines interested in the back have succeeded in creating an army of the partially disabled in this country with their medieval concepts of structural damage and injury as the basis of back pain. Though it is often difficult, every patient has to work through his or her fear and return to full, normal physical activity. One must do this not simply for the sake of becoming a normal human being again, though that's a good enough reason, physically and psychologically by itself. One must do this to liberate oneself from the fear of physical activity, which is often more effective than pain in keeping one's mind focused on the body. That is the purpose of TMS, to keep the mind from attending to emotional things. As Snoopy, that great contemporary philosopher, once said, "There's nothing like a little physical pain to keep your mind off your emotional problems." I now believe that the physical restrictions imposed by TMS are much more important than the pain, thus making it imperative that the patient gradually overcome them. If patients cannot do this, they are doomed to have recurrences of pain. It should be noted parenthetically that the advice to resume normal physical activity, including the most vigorous, has been given to a very large number of patients over the past 27 years. I cannot recall one person who has subsequently said that this advice caused him or her to have further back trouble. I suggest to patients that they begin the process of resuming physical activity when they experience a significant reduction in pain, and when they are feeling confident about the diagnosis. To start prematurely only means that they will probably induce pain, frighten themselves, and retard the recovery process. Patients are usually conditioned to expect pain with physical activity, and so must not challenge the established programmed patterns until they have developed a fair degree of confidence in the diagnosis. One of my patients, an attorney in his mid-30s, had an interesting experience in this regard. He went through the program uneventfully, and in a few weeks was free of pain and doing everything except one thing. He was afraid to run. He explained to me later that it had been drummed into his head for so many years that running was bad for your back that he simply couldn't get up the courage to try, though he could do many things more strenuous than running. After almost a year, he decided that this was silly, and he was going to run. He did, and his pain returned. Now he was at a crossroads. Should he continue to run or back off? He called for my advice, but unfortunately I was on vacation and he had to make his own decision. Wisely, he decided to bullet through. He continued to run, and he continued to hurt. Then one night, he was awakened from sleep with a very sharp pain in the upper back, but his low back pain was gone. Knowing that TMS often moves to different places during the process of recovery, he decided that he had probably won, and he had. Within a couple of days, the upper back pain was gone too, and he has not had a recurrence of either upper or lower back pain since that time. One has to confront TMS, fight it, or the symptoms will continue. Losing one's fear and resuming normal physical activity is possibly the most important part of the therapeutic process. Another essential for full recovery is that all forms of physical treatment or therapy must be abandoned. It is instructive to consider that I did not stop prescribing physical therapy until 12 or 13 years after I began to make the diagnosis. It took that long for me to fully break with all the old traditions in which I had been schooled. Conceptually, prescribing physical therapy contradicts what we have found to be the only rational way to treat the problem. That is, by teaching and through education, invalidating the process where it begins, in the mind. Further, it had become obvious that some patients had put all their confidence in the physical therapy and were having placebo cures, which meant that sooner or later they would be in pain again. The principle is that one must renounce any structural explanation, either for the pain or its cure, or the symptoms will continue. Manipulation, heat, massage, exercise, and acupuncture all presuppose a physical disorder that can be treated by some physical means. Unless that whole concept is repudiated, the pain and other symptoms continue. Patients are usually shocked when it is suggested that they stop the exercises and stretching they have been taught to do for their backs. But it is essential in order to establish firmly in the mind what is important. Exercise for the sake of good health is, of course, something else, and it is strongly encouraged. Another important strategy, but one which must not become a ritual, is a review of daily reminders. Patients are given a list of 12 key thoughts, and it is suggested that at least once a day they set aside 15 minutes or so when they can relax and quietly review them. 1. The pain is due to TMS, not to a structural abnormality. 2. The direct reason for the pain is mild oxygen deprivation. 3. TMS is a harmless condition caused by my repressed emotions. 4. The principal emotion is my repressed anger. 5. TMS exists only to distract my attention from the emotions. 6. Since my back is basically normal, there is nothing to fear. 7. Therefore, physical activity is not dangerous. 8. and I must resume all normal physical activity. 9. I will not be concerned or intimidated by the pain. 10. I will shift my attention from the pain to emotional issues. 11. I intend to be in control, not my unconscious mind. 12. I must think psychological at all times, not physical. By the end of the second lecture discussion, it is assumed that the information about TMS has been intellectually processed. Patients are then urged to give this information an opportunity to, quote, sink in, to be integrated, to be accepted at an unconscious level. Conscious acceptance, though essential as a first step, is not sufficient to reverse the TMS. Patients are instructed to give it 2 to 4 weeks and then call me if they have not made sufficient progress. If they have not, I arrange either to see them in my office or, more commonly, attend a small group meeting composed of patients like themselves who have made little or no progress, or those having recurrences after having been free of pain for months or years. It is the purpose of these sessions to uncover the reason for the recurrence or lack of progress and to review the whole TMS process. The first thing to ascertain is that the patient understands and accepts the diagnosis. Let's take a theoretical patient, a 50-year-old businessman. He comes to the meeting because he hasn't improved after attending the lectures. What are some of the possible reasons? 1. He accepts 90% of the diagnosis, but still has some concerns that the herniated disc demonstrated on the CT scan or MRI has something to do with the pain. 2. He finds it hard to believe that this thing can go away with just an education program. 3. He accepts the diagnosis, but can't get up the courage to begin physical activity. Mental impediments such as these allow the brain to continue the TMS, since the man is still engaged with his symptoms as a physical disorder. As long as he is in any way preoccupied with what his body is doing, the pain will continue. His confidence in the diagnosis needs to be built up so that he can accept the fact that he has TMS. The person sitting next to him is a 30-year-old homemaker, wife, and mother. She tells us that she is no better since the lectures, but she is not surprised because her life remains as hectic as ever. She is perpetually tired and harassed, and she never feels as though she has done as well as she should. It is pointed out to her that she will never cease being a perfectionist and a goodist, that she will always have too much to do, but that the secret of getting over TMS is not changing oneself, but simply recognizing that the combination of the realities of her life and personality cause her to generate an enormous amount of anger to the point of rage. Yes, rage. She has probably never acknowledged the fact that although she adores her 3 little girls, she is simultaneously angry at them for what they require of her. The idea that she could be unconsciously angry at her children is outside of her experience. When she grasps the idea that the cure is in the acknowledgement of such unacceptable, unconscious feelings, the pain will cease. The man in the back row, who next raises his hand, is a 45-year-old construction foreman who came through the program 3 years ago and had been doing fine until last week. No pain, no physical restrictions, no problems. Then, out of the blue, he developed an acute low back spasm and is now having severe pain. If he hadn't been through the program, he would really be scared, but he can't understand why this has happened. "What's going on in your life?" I ask him. "Nothing in particular," he says. "My wife is fine. The children are well. We don't have any health or financial problems." But the occurrence of an acute spasm means that there has to be something psychological going on, because TMS is an emotional barometer. So I continue to question him, and finally it comes out that there have been problems on the job, difficulties with some of the men he supervises, and criticism from his superior. "Nothing I can't handle," he says. But he doesn't realize that although he's handling it, he's generating large quantities of unconscious anger in the process. There is always important emotional activity going on below the level of consciousness, and we have no way of knowing about it unless from experience we learn to suspect it and anticipate it. He leaves the meeting a little wiser about how his emotional insides work. The back pain will subside, and hopefully he will think about his inner reactions the next time he's confronted with a stressful situation. The small group meetings have proven to be a valuable therapeutic tool. Patients not only gain understanding about their own situations, but profit from the experiences of others. It's always reassuring to know that there are others going through the same thing you are. These meetings also give me an opportunity to decide which patients may need the assistance of a psychotherapist. Although about 85% of our patients go through the program without psychotherapy, some will need such help. This means simply that they have higher levels of anxiety, anger, and other repressed feelings, and that their brains are not going to give up this convenient strategy of hiding these feelings without a struggle. When someone tells me he is having trouble accepting the diagnosis, I suspect that there is resistance in the unconscious to giving up the TMS. I recall a patient who reported that when he began to become aware of these long repressed feelings through psychotherapy, his feelings were so painful and frightening that he was reluctant to deal with them. These are not people suffering from mental illness. These are people who are leading normal, productive lives, but who have unconscious emotional baggage that they have never been aware of. Sometimes things happen in childhood that leave one with a large reservoir of resentment and anger, but the feelings are kept deeply buried because they are too scary or socially unacceptable to be allowed to reach consciousness. This tendency to repress bad feelings is universal. It's something we all do to a greater or lesser extent. It is not neurotic, or we are all neurotic. But in some, as in a person who was abused as a child, the repressed feelings may be strong. It is necessary for them to have help in recognizing that those feelings are there and in learning how to deal with them. That is the role of psychotherapy. I have great admiration for the people who go through our program. They must overcome some not inconsiderable impediments before they can get better. One of these is the skepticism and sometimes the ridicule they encounter. Another is the constant admonition, usually from family members, to be careful. Don't lift that. Don't bend over. Be sure to put on your corset. For this reason, I encourage the full participation of close family members so that they will not undermine the therapeutic process. One of the biggest problems for patients is developing confidence that they can banish this physical disorder with a learning program. That kind of thing is completely outside of people's medical experience. It is my job to convince them that it can be done. I should emphasize that I don't consider someone to have been successfully treated unless he or she is free of significant pain and is able to engage in unrestricted physical activity without fear. As I said before, the fear of physical activity may be more disabling than the pain for someone with a chronic pain problem. Virtually everyone I have seen has been a prisoner of fear, of hurting himself, of bringing on an attack, and that works even better than the pain to keep the attention focused on the body instead of the emotions. It is our job to liberate them from this pervasive fear. One of the more difficult concepts to grasp is the fact that one does not have to eliminate tension from one's life. People ask, how can I change my personality? How do I stop generating anxiety and anger? If these were prerequisites for recovery, my cure rate would be zero. It is not changing one's emotions. It is recognizing that they exist and that the brain is trying to keep one from being aware of their existence through the mechanism of the pain syndrome. That is the key point in understanding why the knowledge is the effective cure. One thing that is abundantly clear about the cause and treatment of TMS is that it is a striking example of the mind-body connection. The history of medicine's awareness of this interaction is long and checkered. Hippocrates advised his asthmatic patients to be wary of anger, which suggests that 2,500 years ago, there was some appreciation of the impact of the emotions on illness. Why do contemporary physicians have trouble with mind-body concepts? I believe it is because they see themselves as engineers to the human body. According to them, health and illness can be expressed in physical and chemical terms, and the idea that a thought or an emotion could somehow have an effect on that physical chemistry is anathema. This is why my work has been so studiously ignored. I have demonstrated conclusively that a truly physical pathological process is the result of emotional phenomena and can be halted by a mental process. That is, first of all, rank heresy. Second, it is beyond the comprehension of most physicians. Nothing in their training prepared them for such an idea, and to them it smacks of voodoo. Paradoxically, thoughtful laymen are much more able to accept such an idea because they are not burdened with a medical education and all the philosophical biases that go along with it. Contemporary medicine is scientifically limited because it has closed itself off from further progress, being unwilling to venture out beyond the secure boundaries of its familiar technology. It ought to take a lesson from the field of theoretical physics, where old ideas are constantly being revised in the light of new knowledge. Dr. H.K. Beecher was one of the first serious students of pain in the United States. In 1946, he published an article in the Annals of Surgery titled Pain in Men Wounded in Battle. For years, it was widely quoted because of its most interesting observation. During World War II, Dr. Beecher questioned 215 seriously wounded soldiers at various locations in the European theater shortly after they had been wounded. He found that 75% of them had so little pain that they had no need for morphine. Reflecting that strong emotion can block pain, Dr. Beecher went on to speculate, quote, "In this connection, it is important to consider the position of the soldier. His wound suddenly releases him from an exceedingly dangerous environment, one filled with fatigue, discomfort, anxiety, fear, and real danger of death, and gives him a ticket to the safety of the hospital. His troubles are over, or he thinks they are." Unquote. This observation is reinforced by a report of the United States Surgeon General during World War II, noted in Martin Gilbert's book, The Second World War, A Complete History, that in order to avoid psychiatric breakdown, infantrymen had to be relieved of duty every so often. The report said, quote, "A wound or injury is regarded not as a misfortune, but a blessing." Unquote. Here is yet another way in which the mind can modify or eliminate pain. Good spirits, a joyful attitude, a positive emotional state, clearly have the ability to block or prevent pain. Just how this works, one cannot know at this time. But we do know in part how the therapeutic process in TMS works. The knowledge of what the brain is about renders the process purposeless. The abnormal autonomic stimuli cease, and so does the pain. What we have yet to discover, and it is probably beyond our mental horizons to do so at this time, is how emotional phenomena can stimulate physiologic ones. That they do is unquestionable. But for the time being, we may have to be content with Benjamin Franklin's observation, "Nor is it of much importance to us to know the manner in which nature executes her laws. 'Tis enough to know the laws themselves."
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.